Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Jokes, says my guest today, are little machines to make us laugh. They go way back in history and in the minds of philosophers, to Greeks and Romans, Plato and Kant and Sigmund Freud, and of course, Henny Youngman.
She ran after the garbage man. Am I too late for the garbage? She says, no, jump in. Take my wife, please.
Oh, please. And still, we laugh. And have for centuries. Why? This hour on Point, What's in a Joke? We'll take a crack at the history and philosophy. Later in this hour, we'll look at the funny, not funny debate over the New Yorker magazine's controversial new Obama cover. But joining me right now from New York is Jim Holt, longtime contributor to the New Yorker and New York Times magazine. He writes mostly about science and philosophy. His new book, out yesterday, is Stop Me If You've Heard This, A History and Philosophy of Jokes. Jim Holt, welcome.
Hello, Tom. Nice to be here.
Thanks for coming. Jokes, how far back do they go? What's the record? Have humans always been telling them?
This is a question that I began to explore by looking for the origins of something very closely related to jokes, namely laughter. Laughter is something that we are familiar with. We hear it constantly throughout the day. But it's a really weird thing. You know, if an extraterrestrial scientist came to Earth and began observing us, I think the first thing he would notice is that in the course of communicating with one another using language, every once in a while, we all stop and emit this sort of spasmodic, chest-heaving, cackling sound.
Kind of shuddering and exhaling and...
Yeah. And everyone laughs in a slightly different way. Other people's laughter can be very annoying. But where did this come from? It's a, you know, it seems to be a luxury reflex. It has no obvious evolutionary function. Another odd thing about it is that it's evoked. There's a vector that goes from the mental to the physical. You hear something, and there's something nonsensical or incongruous about it, and suddenly you're emitting this reflexive behavior. So it's the only domain of creative activity where a cerebral stimulus, namely a joke or some bit of humor, issues in this sort of stereotype physiological reflex that we call laughter.
Well, okay, let's go to laughter before we even get to the joke. You've got your theory on it. Maybe it's just conjecture, but you started to take it back to evolution. You imagine, prehistoric men, women running around hunting, being threatened by this or that, sending out or feeling the tension of threat in the air, and then somebody, which is serious, and then somebody indicates not to worry, and everybody's got that little ripple of relief. Seems related, as I hear and read you, Jim, to the experience we have when we come to the end of many jokes.
Exactly. Something that looks disturbing, that looks threatening, is suddenly, through a surprising reinterpretation, is not a threat at all. It's trivial. It's nothing. Threatening something dissolves into nothingness. So that you can imagine in the primeval jungle, if a band of your fellow humanoids, you go out for a hunt or something, and suddenly you see a dangerous snake hanging from a tree, or you think you do. And then one member said, no, it's not a tree at all. It's just a bit of rotting leaves or whatever. And emits this.
It's almost a laugh.
That wasn't a very good example. But emits this sort of stereotype vocalization. And what's the other thing about laughter? It's contagious. So it spreads through the whole group, and everyone knows that the dangerous something is really a trivial nothing. Yeah, and this is very much what a joke is like. There's something kind of weird about the setup. This is a very good example. I was listening to an NPR show years ago, a classical music broadcast. And after one of the pieces, the announcer came on and said, by the way, why is it so hard to find the composer of the Surprise Symphony? And I thought, what could this mean? You know, what bit of music history is he alluding to? And then he said, because he's Haydn.
And so, and off we go. And that, but there's the trick. I mean, it's not just laughter rippling through a crowd. It's laughter that's sort of created, sparked, designed, and delivered by a joke. You call jokes a medium for fantasizing about what must be avoided in reality, a way of laughing off our cruel, irrational, and aggressive instincts, or maybe just a kind of disjuncture there, or surprise ending like you've gotten in your little Haydn quip.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are three classic theories of jokes and of humor. One theory is the theory that is, in a sense, the most primitive is called the superiority theory. And the gist of this is that we laugh when we feel suddenly are made to feel superior to someone, the people around us, or to someone in our environment, in our social environment. So as Thomas Hobbes, the 17th century British philosopher, put it, we laugh when we feel a sudden glory at the humiliation of others. And this superiority theory of jokes explains a certain class of jokes, certainly, jokes, racist jokes, ethnic jokes, jokes about drunkards and henpecked husbands and cuckolds and even lawyers, people that we feel superior to. And then there's the Freud's theory of jokes, which sees, as Freud typically did, it sees sex at the root of every joke. Not the forbidden impulses, usually of a sexual but sometimes of an aggressive nature. And so for Freud, the point of a joke was to allow a temporary liberation of these forbidden impulses, usually sexual impulses.
So Freudian. Of course.
the setup sort of fools you. It tricks the inner censor that keeps down the forbidden material. And then the punchline forces you to think of things in a way that you don't want to think about them. And suddenly these forbidden impulses are liberated, and all of the energy that you were using to bottle them up, the energy that you used to repress them, is suddenly liberated. And you express it in this sort of chest-heaving, cackling, spasmodic laughter. So, of course, Freud's theory is very good for, naughty jokes, improper, lewd jokes, sexual jokes. Mm. And I certainly won't tell any of those today.
Well, that's half the book right there.
They're only I only include them as clinical specimens,
but
of
course.
They are not meant to be amusing.
But though you note all polls show that they are far and away the most popular. And your third variety?
The third theory is the incongruity theory that says that what we take delight in is when suddenly we see surprising conceptual connections between things that seem utterly different. A good, very simple example of incongruity. I see this a lot when I'm walking the streets of New York City, as I'm wont to do. You see a garbage truck come barreling down the street, and stuck in the grill of the garbage, this big, nasty-looking truck, smelly and emitting lots of vile fumes, with hard-faced men sitting behind the wheel. And stuck in the grill of the truck, you see a little stuffed animal. This is a perfect sort of incongruity, I think.
And watch it shows out, or my fuzzy teddy bear will hit you first before my massive hunk of junk.
And so the incongruity theory, which was developed by Pascal, the philosopher, who said that what amuses us is the expectation of something dissolving into nothing. And, Kant, Immanuel Kant, the great German philosopher of the late 18th century, put it in that way too. And this explains what I would call the higher humor, our delight in pure nonsense and pure absurdity. You know, if you go to I recently saw a production of the great Oscar Wilde play, The Importance of Being Earnest.
Yeah.
And in the lines of the play, there's a lot of innuendo about forbidden sexual matters, because of course Wilde was prosecuted for homosexuality and was part of a gay subculture in London at the time, and he was alluding to that a lot. So that makes the humor quite risky. But the great thing about it is the characters are speaking this sort of beautiful nonsense throughout the play. And it's a purely intellectual delight that we take in that. And it has nothing to do with ventilating our aggressive impulses, our feelings of superiority towards another racial or ethnic group, or our naughty sexual impulses. It's a purely intellectual delight.
Of the incongruity that comes after. Let's listen, if we may, Jim, just to a little one here. I mean, this may not be the higher humor, but we had a little Henny Youngman, and here's a little bit more. It may be the incongruity structure of a joke. A clip here from his Take My Album, Please, released on vinyl in 1978. Henny Youngman.
Man goes to the doctor and says, "Doctor, I'm having trouble at home with my love life. What'll I do?" He says, "Take off 20 pounds. Run 10 miles a day." Man calls him 2 weeks later. "Doc, took off the 20 pounds. I've been running 10 miles a day." "Well, how's your love life?" "I don't know. I'm 140 miles away.
Okay. Is that the incongruity structure? Something like that?
In its purest form. Yes. Another Hedy Youngman joke I absolutely love was, I'm sorry, my delivery is terrible. I have no ability to tell jokes. My timing is off. So
lay it on
please
lay
forgive it on. Me. I'm a sheer amateur. I think he said, when I was born, I was so ugly that the doctors slapped my mother. I'm not going to explain why that's incongruous. Thank you. It's very, very kind of you to laugh.
Of the baby. No, we got it. And you've got them going all the way back here. I mean, this is, I don't know, 1,000, 2,000 years old here. We'll talk about it. From the Philogelos, an egghead is on a sea voyage. A big storm blows up and causes his slaves to weaken terror. "Don't cry," he consoles them. "I've freed you all in my will." Wow, it's kind of like they're right there with Hedy Youngman slapping the mom instead of the baby.
Yeah. Goes, there are 200 and about 240 surviving jokes from ancient times, from ancient Greek and Roman times, and they're all collected in this volume called the Philogelos, which means the laughter lover. Mm. And it's the only way we can get an idea of what ancient audiences found funny.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking today about the history and philosophy of jokes. My guest is Jim Holt. He's author of the funny little book, a long essay, really, but it gets to you, and it explains a lot. It's called Stop Me If You've Heard This, A History and Philosophy of Jokes. A little talk about history here and early jokes. We'll come to them. Here's a joke that riffs off of ancient history from British comedian Eddie Izzard, riffing on Heroes of the Trojan War. It's from Glorious, his 1997 performance at the Hammersmith Apollo in London.
All the great warriors came for the siege. Agamemnon, famous warrior. Ajax, famous toilet cleaner. And Achilles, immortal man. Except he had an Achilles heel. The irony of it. Well, Mum, you mean I'm called Achilles and I have an Achilles heel? I'll be a laughing stock.
I like that. That's the British way. And here's American comedienne Roseanne Barr on gay marriage. Paramount Theater, Aurora, Illinois, 2007, September, a week after the mayor in San Diego announced his support for gay marriage in California.
I can't believe what a huge flap the whole gay marriage thing made in the election and how it still makes like a huge stink every place. I mean, we've lost our minds and our common sense. If you think that gay sex is gross, then you should be for their right to marry. Because that'll put an end to all that sex, just like it does for the straight people.
You quote Cicero right at the front of your book, Jim, and indecency, decently put, is the thing we laugh at hardest, and maybe there's a little bit of that right there. Well, let's take a call and hear what our listeners have to think. We'll get to history. William in Nashville, Tennessee. You're on the air, my friend.
Hello. Greetings, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. I'm a fan of the show. Thanks for having me on, and I'm glad you're doing a joke show. I think you're going to need to do this quite frequently.
Me too. Jokes, please.
Okay. I like religious jokes, and here's one. There's a Jewish version of this, and I'm going to give you the Norwegian farmer version, a la Teeler.
Okay, we're bracing ourselves.
Okay. So it's Ole. It's an old from the Ole and Lena series. Ole is stranded on a desert island. He's alone for 15 years. He's stranded. He's finally discovered, and before they leave the island, he says, "I just want to show you around, you know, a little bit here, show you what I've done on the island. I built, this is my house. Here's my barn, and then this building here, that's where I go to church, you know." And somebody notices another building. He says, "Well, Ole, what's that?" And he goes, "Oh, yeah, well, that's a church I used to go to."
Okay. William, bravo. Thanks very much. Jim Holt, that's the church I used to go to. What have you got there? What's the structure? Why does it get us?
I would not dare dissect that joke. I would leave it dead on the table. I do. Religion jokes are some of the best. There's a joke for every religious sect, as you may or may not know. And some of them are very fraught, and members of one or another religion will find them very offensive in many cases. The one religious group that I find that is the most willing and enlightened butt of humor are the Unitarians. The Unitarians, very tolerant, very broad-minded. And one joke I like
and
is—
And not certain what it's all about at the end of the day, and you've got a joke on them, yes?
What do you do to protest the fact? To protest when a Unitarian family moves into your neighborhood? You burn a question mark on their lawn.
Wow! So we got the kind nasty energy of burning crosses and this sort of light, ambiguity of Unitarian philosophy. I don't know.
Yes, the question mark at the heart of the Unitarian philosophy, Unitarian religion defined as the religion believes that there is at most one God.
But, of course, to William's joke, it gets right at the human foible, that even all alone on a desert island, mm-hmm. when it comes to religion, we find a way to make a conflict, to build two churches of our own and leave one mm-hmm. for another. That's good. That's great. That's crazy. Let's go to Tico in Saratoga Springs, New York. Tico, you're on the air.
Yes. Hello, Tom.
Hi.
There's a category of jokes that tickle me a lot, and I don't know how to name them, but it's what gets me is when somebody has a punchline, and usually there's a long-winded kind of involved delivery to it, and you get to the punchline, and it makes me laugh in many cases because I realize that somebody had a phrase or a word, a couple words together, and they created a whole joke just to go with that phrase. And I like to think, about the person sitting down in a lawn chair and saying, I've got this great punchline. Now I'm going to make a joke about it. And those jokes get me a lot.
I know exactly what you mean, though I'm lousy at remembering jokes. I cannot pull one to mind, but it always makes me think, as you suggest, who went to the trouble to reverse engineer an entire joke off of a potentially funny punchline? Jim Holt, you've thought about this a little bit in the book, but I mean, who builds jokes? Who sits around making them? Where do they come from?
The only joke that's even vaguely in that genre that I can think of is your monkey starving? Yes, we have no bananas.
Okay. Yeah. Phew. Yeah. That's it. That's the form.
Yeah. Try to do a better job feigning laughter, Todd.
Okay,
I mean, that was even more feeble than the joke. Who makes up jokes? I don't know.
You suggest that they come from bored stockbrokers sitting around in bullpens full of guys with nothing else to do.
Stockbrokers, yes. Before the internet, stockbrokers had their own electronic communications network, and when the market's boring and they're not making trades, they trade jokes. Another theory is that jokes are produced in prisons because prisoners have a lot of time on their hands. They have a captive audience. And then in the 80s and 90s, these theories merged as stockbrokers began going to prison.
and we had one great big joke factory. Flash forward with us on history, if you would, from the ancient Greeks. And you describe what kind of comedy clubs there were. Hundreds of Greeks would hang out and tell jokes, I guess. But then you get us to the Middle Ages. After a pretty rough time for humor in Europe, the Arab world had most of the good humor going on. And suddenly you've got this guy, Italian, sort of high secretary to the Pope, Bracciolini, and he's...
Poggio Bracciolini, yes.
Yeah.
He was a papal secretary. He served a total of 8 popes, wrote bulls and dispensations and so forth, along with the other papal secretaries. And after a hard day of drafting this tedious sort of correspondence, they would knock off and...
Writing bulls, what a tough job.
Writing bulls, yeah. And they had a little club called the Bujale, or Fib Factory, as it translates. And they'd crack jokes and trade jokes.
This is a bon vivant. He was secretary to 8 popes, you write, over half a century, fathered 14 children with a mistress before taking at age 55 an 18-year-old bride, 6 more children. So this was a guy who liked to live.
Yes. He was also a great, great Renaissance scholar. He went around to the monasteries of Europe and saved great classical manuscripts that otherwise would have moldered into dust. So we really owe him a great debt of gratitude, civilization does.
And he put together
a collection
of jokes,
as a collector of jokes. By the way, in the Cathedral of Florence, there was a statue of him that was sculpted by Donatello. And about 100 years ago, I think, there were some renovations to the cathedral, and they moved the statue of Poggio. So he's up with the four evangelists, with Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, which I think is a great irony.
Okay. You've got a couple of his jokes here, and these are from his collection. Pronounce it for me. It's the Liber...
It's a facetiae. They're facetious stories, so they're called the facetiae.
All right. So you've got the abbot of Septimo, an extremely corpulent man, traveling toward Florence one evening. And here I'm reading from your book. Stop me if you've heard this. On the road, he asked a peasant, and this is a corpulent, a big-sized man. On the road, he asked the peasant, "Do you think I'll be able to get to make it through the city gate?" Talking about whether or not he'll get there in the evening before the gate's closed. And the peasant, jesting on the abbot's fatness, says, "Well, if a cart of hay can make it through, you can too." Okay. Laugh line, course, circa 1400?
Yes, yes. And Poggio, of course, has to give away the joke by the phrase, "jesting on his fatness."
Yeah.
So a lot of these jokes fall flat. One odd thing that I noticed, I was watching the American TV show Curb Your Enthusiasm a few years ago, and Larry David and his wife Cheryl were married. They're in bed together. Yeah. And Cheryl says, "Larry, why is it that I'm always the one who has to initiate sex?" And Cheryl says this to Larry. Larry says, "Well, it's simple. We men are always in the mood. Whenever you want it, just tap me on the shoulder." And I thought, wait a minute. That
rings
that
a bell?
That echoes with something I've heard. Mm. And I remembered now that there was one of the jokes in this Renaissance scholars collection, in Poggio's collection. It was exactly the reverse of that. I'm looking, it's facetiae number 50-something or other. I'm terrible with Roman numerals. Mm. When a husband asks his wife why, if women and men get equal pleasure out of sex, it's the men who pursue the women rather than vice versa. It's obvious, the wife says, we women are always ready to make love and you men aren't. What good would it do to solicit you when you're not in the mood? This, by the way, is a sort of a naughty premise of many jokes that women are full of, you know, bursting with libido. Men would like to think this, but...
But who knows? Larry David didn't get that kind of respect lying in bed with his wife in the show. And then there's this one again from the Renaissance, same collection, Poggio's, a friar preaching against adultery, concluded by declaring, "It is such an abominable sin that I would rather sleep with 10 virgins than a single married woman," to which Poggio adds, "Many who heard him felt the same way."
Blue here. I didn't think I could. I would have used that one
if you had the liberty.
You stole it from me.
Hey, unleash your inner Freud just a little. David's calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I had a question. Your guest was talking about which groups have different humors, and I was thinking about Jewish humor, and I was also thinking that there's a category where that humor comes out of pain. Or out of angst and anxiety. And I was wondering if your guest has that as one of the categories out of which humor flows.
Yes, indeed. No small attention to Jewish humor in this long essay. Jim Holt, what do you say?
You know, what's interesting about the Jewish predilection for humor, if you look at the great comedians of the 20th century, It's much easier to name the Gentiles than the Jews. It's like great violinists. You can count the great non-Jewish violinists on the fingers of one hand. They're almost all Jewish. Why would the Jewish people have a special penchant for joking? Well, one interesting reason is they have a tradition of Talmudic reasoning. There's this enormous body of commentary on the Torah called the Talmud. And it's all about pursuing logical nuances and pursuing linguistic nuances without any regard for practical importance. And it's this tradition of delighting in logic and language for its own sake that you see sort of informing a lot of Jewish humor. And then secondly, there's the fact that because of persecution and pogroms, Jews are always having to leave one country and go to another. And what happens when you do that? You encounter a new language. And when you encounter a new language, you see that language as a sort of external object. And all of its absurdities and the punning possibilities and so forth are much fresher to you. So that may be another reason. And then, of course, the third reason, as your caller pointed out, is a lot of Jewish humor is a sort of gallows humor, you know, laughing in the face of suffering. At a philosophical level, it's laughing in the face of incomprehensibility.
Mm.
And so this is my pat, you know, amateur theory of why there's a special Jewish passion for humor. One other thing I might add is that Freud thought that neurotics were the most fertile sources for jokes because they're the most troubled by these weird impulses that are always bubbling up for their unconscious. And now I'm certainly not going to say that that Jews are more neurotic than Gentiles, but there is a sort of a savoring and relishing of neurosis. And I think I'm thinking of Woody Allen, who's sort of the paradigm of this.
And of course, we know that one well. But Jews not alone in pulling humor, even at cost to themselves, out of pain and history. Here's a little bit from Chris Rock on racism, 1996 performance called Bring the Pain, his first HBO special filmed live in Washington, D.C.
Now, we got a lot of things, a lot of racism going on in the world right now. Who's more racist, black people or white people? Black people. You know why? Because we hate black people, too.
A little pain and a little history right there. Let's take a call from Boston. Stephen, you're on the air, Stephen.
Greetings, gentlemen.
Hi.
I have to tell you, when something is clever, you never forget it once you hear it. And I heard 30 years ago on another fine radio station in Boston a limerick contest. And I promise this is clean and clever.
Okay.
I heard it once and have never forgotten it in 30 years.
Oh, bring it on.
Here we go. There once was a fella named Clyde who fell through an outhouse and died. Along came his brother who fell through the other. And now they're interred side by side.
Stephen,
I leave you. Have a great day.
Thank you very much for that.
Very nice.
Thank you very much. Freud gets a lot of attention in the world of humor and in your book, partly because he's among those big thinkers who was willing to really spend some time with this. He drew connections between jokes, Jim Holt, and dreams. What did he see in common there?
Right. Well, when Freud was writing The Interpretation of Dreams, his great treatise on dreams and their logic, one of his colleagues said, you know, there are a lot of jokes in these dreams. And this is what got Freud thinking about the resemblance between jokes and dreams. In both, meanings are displaced, logic is scrambled, things are identified with their opposites and so forth. And I think that a lot of time I have jokes in my dreams, and I know this is true of other people. You're having a dream, and suddenly either you tell a joke or someone in the dream tells a joke, and I often laugh myself awake. And then the first thing that occurs to me was, that was a pretty good joke. And then 5 seconds later, wasn't that funny a joke? And then another few seconds elapse, and I think, that wasn't funny at all. Someone once said that the jokes in Shakespeare's plays are like the jokes in dreams. They have the logical form of jokes, but they aren't funny at all. By the way, may I just say a few words about the morality of jokes?
Oh, yes, please. We've got a rich minute.
The idea that a joke can a truly immoral joke be funny? This is, I think, one of the great puzzles for me. If a joke is genuinely funny, does that funniness redeem the improper content? And I went back and looked at jokes that I think we could all agree are beyond the pale. And a really good example was the one that I'm not going to quote it because it's foul. It was told by Earl Butz, who you may remember was the Secretary of Agriculture under Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford.
And just barely a joke, no twist in it, just a kind of a really racist rag on African Americans.
It was a joke, yes, exactly. It was simply three racial stereotypes sort of clumsily and presented, and there was no paralogical twist. There was no incongruity. And he was overheard telling this joke on a plane, and it was published in the Rolling Stone, and he had to resign. And it seems to me that this is sort of confirmation of my theory that you can't have humor and complete immorality at the same time. But I'm not at all sure that's true.
You quote Legman? Is it Gershon Legman?
Gershon Legman.
Talking about the infinite aggression that's built in to the world of jokes and behind so many jokes. Jim Holt, I wish we had so much time, but there's a joke on the cover of The New Yorker, so intended anyway, that we've got to talk about here, and we will in a minute. Loved your book. Stop Me If You've Heard This, A History and Philosophy of Jokes. Thank you for joining us, Jim.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back in a moment with that New Yorker cover, Barack and Michelle Obama in the Oval Office. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Barack Obama and his wife Michelle are on the cover of the New Yorker magazine this week. No snappy suits and pillbox hats for them in the cartoon Oval Office. He's depicted in a traditional Muslim robe and turban. She's in camo and combat boots with an assault rifle slung over her shoulder. The American flag burns in the fireplace. They share a terrorist fist jab under an Osama bin Laden portrait. The New Yorker says it's send-up satire, a skewering of stereotypes that its readers will get, will understand. The Obama camp says it's not funny. What do you think? We put together a panel to ask just what they think of it. Joining us from Hoover, Alabama, is Scott Stantis. He's an editorial cartoonist for the Birmingham News. Scott, welcome back to On Point.
Well, thanks for having me, Tom.
With us from Philadelphia, Carolyn Marvin, professor at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. Carolyn, welcome again to the show.
Nice to be with you.
And with us from Washington, D.C., Clarence Page, nationally syndicated columnist for the Chicago Tribune. Clarence, thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom. Always great to see you, great to hear you.
Great to have you, my friend. So we've got heavyweights on tap for a cartoon on the cover of a magazine. Where do we go first here? Scott, you're the cartoonist. What did you think?
I got to tell you, the most offensive part of this is not the satire. It's not the image. It's just that it's a lousy cartoon. I have the same objection with this that I have with the Danish Muhammad cartoons of a few years back. That not, satire is supposed to be, invocative. It's supposed to get your attention, but it's also supposed to make sense. And the problem with this cover is it doesn't make a heck of a lot of sense because there's no context to it. So anyone whose, IQ is above room temperature knows what they're trying to say with this cover. It's obviously using all of the more vehement opponents of the Obamas and painting that image of them. However, if you're going to say this is how they're viewed by somebody, you have to show the somebody who's viewing them that way, and this cover doesn't do that.
We'll look at that. I mean, maybe there's a context. Maybe David Remnick, editor there, would say all of America is the audience, but it's not in the cartoon. Carolyn Marvin, what did you make of it? Is this satire in the grand tradition or a bust?
Oh, I think it is satire in the grand tradition. I think the reaction has been very interesting. And for me, it raises two issues, and one is, what is the purpose of political cartooning? And I think that purpose is to show us to ourselves in some way. And so then the next question is, what is it showing us? And I think there's a variety of different levels here that are pretty interesting. One is, Obama has been trying so hard to get away from the 60s. He's explicitly repudiated those arguments, and here they are, right on the cover of The New Yorker with Michelle looking a bit like Angela Davis.
Yeah.
And, there's a kind of throwback here to Louis Farrakhan, the notion of black Muslims and so forth. And then I think with that burning flag, there's that other question, which is, if you criticize the government in time of war, which both Michelle and Obama have done implicitly or explicitly, does that mean that you are become the enemy in some way of the United States? But I think the most interesting level of all here is just the discomfort that I think white Americans feel with Islam in general. I mean, there are certainly Muslims who are African-American and white in the United States, but there's this idea that, while many people would be uncomfortable saying or believing that it's not possible to have a black man in the Oval Office, there are other people of color that if Obama were associated with them, somehow he might be the kind of black man that you could be suspicious of. So I think this is also at a level about the discomfort that the United States and even supporters of Obama sometimes have with Islam itself.
I'm sure the New Yorker wouldn't argue with that, but Clarence Page, they are really getting roasted and toasted for this, saying, mm-hmm. people saying, you are fueling the flames of the very worst kind of stereotypes and caricatures and all the rest here. I mean, is this an insult to black America, Clarence Page, to have, the first candidate, presumptive nominee this far along the road portrayed, in such jest with so much edge on it?
Well, Tom, as you can, indicate, the Obamas are indeed cherished iconic figures in Black America, if not in liberal America in general, where nerves are already rubbed raw by the sense of having 2000 elections stolen from them, the 2004 swift voted away by stereotypes that were false against John Kerry, and this year we've seen the rumor mill, the smear campaigns that are portraying these very stereotypes out there, and that's what the New Yorker is lampooning. Let me say, first of all, that the editorial cartoonists are the most courageous people in the newspaper. My hat's off to you, Scott, because their job is to upset people. If a cartoon doesn't upset somebody, you've failed, just like with columnists. But cartoons are literally black and white. They got to put it right out there. Number two, the New Yorker cover is not a cartoon. It's a caricature. There's a nuance of difference in the business, and it's more than academic. Mm-hmm. The New Yorker was illustrating an article inside by Ryan Lizza, which is actually rather complimentary of Obama.
On Obama's Chicago politics, which you know well. Mm-hmm.
Right, and it's a liberal magazine. Like Scott said, the picture doesn't have context, but anybody who knows New Yorker knows it's liberal. It's aimed at New York folks, a sophisticated audience nationwide that does know that these are false images. Number three, a lot of the fear among my fellow liberals is that this is going to generate or perpetuate stereotypes. Folks, the stereotypes are out there already. There was one conservative website that did like this email poll, and like something like 65% of their readers said they thought that the picture had some foundation to it in real life. Now, whether they're just talking about the fist bump itself, or if they're talking about the notion that Michelle Obama is some kind of a militant, or Barack is some kind of a secret Muslim, the fact is a lot of folks out there in red state America do have these beliefs. So I know where that cover art was headed. But I also winced when I saw it, because I knew it was going to upset folks, and so I still applaud the New Yorker for their courage.
I mean, Michelle is still cute in this cover with her nicely fitted camo pants there, and Obama's still got presence. But, you know, this goes right to all the fears. This is subtext or open text of an awful lot of right-wing chatter about Obama. You know, maybe this is funny and satire in the hoity-toity precincts of the New Yorker editorial offices, but gasoline, Clarence, out there in the world.
Well, you know, that's the thing, gasoline, as I say, we're a daily business in daily journalism. The New Yorker's a weekly business. You make judgment calls all the time. I know Dave Remnick. I know that he's a guy.
Yeah, we do too.
Who,
yep.
You know, every so often he likes to put on a cover that astonishes people. I have cited the cover they had back a few years ago when there were heavy Black Jewish tensions in New York. New Yorker came out with a cover with a Hasidic Jewish male embracing and kissing a Black woman. And there you had all kinds of stuff, you know, folks on the one side saying this is horrible, outrageous, folks on the other side saying, oh, this is cute, it's heartwarming, it's edgy. They were trying the same thing this time. I don't think it succeeded as well as before, but I tell you, we're talking about it. People across the country are talking about this, and I think in the long run, a lot of folks who actually sincerely believe out of ignorance that Barack Obama is some secret Muslim and all, they're going to get a chance to maybe go to Snopes.com or someplace and find out the truth.
Obama campaign spokesman Bill Burton said in a statement, most readers will see it as tasteless and offensive, and we agree. Clarence Page, Carolyn, Scott Standis, please stand by. A lot of listeners want to join us. Peggy in Portsmouth, Virginia, what do you think, Peggy?
Thanks for taking my call. I saw the cover, and I also listened to the Fresh Ear commentary yesterday on this article. There is one point that's missing. Black Americans have a different sense of humor than white Americans. I would bet that Michelle Obama was more offended by this cover than Barack Obama was, just because he is a man of color that was raised, born outside of this country. I know he's an American, but he was born outside and raised outside of this country. He perceives his color in a little different light than a black-born American man does. But I thought the article was funny. I thought the cover was funny. I thought the article was very serious. But I knew it was going to upset a lot of black folks because they have a love language that whites do not share.
But isn't humor, well, okay, I guess not all humor can be shared, but I mean, you know, some might pick up on what... Yes, please, Clarence.
I would say that liberals were going to be upset by the cover. That was my reaction, not just black folks, because there's a strong component here. And, you know, just a lot of folks who like Barack Obama for a variety of reasons were going to be upset because they do see it playing to a cheap shot stereotype.
But do you see Michelle getting more upset with this than Barack? And if you do, does that feed right into the caricature that's being made here, that she's the, you know, the sort of tail-kicking mama with the bandoliers on?
Well, I know Barack and Michelle well enough to say that I think they're both probably upset by it, but they've been upset by a lot of things that have been said about them, I'm sure.
Let me get a call from Lexington, South Carolina. John, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I have two quick points to make. Number one, I think timing is a real important thing. If this had come out the week after he was elected, you know, he was the president-elect, it'd have a different effect. I don't think they'd be as upset about it. Because, right. Number two, as much as we want to say that real smart people will see past this, there's a lot of ignorant people in the United States that they still need their votes. And ignorant people can't get past it. And if certain people in certain conversations in their home and in their bars or restaurants or friends, whatever, they're talking about, hey, what if Obama was, you know, part of the Muslim sect, or what if this or what if that? This just adds to the stereotype that he's trying to avoid, that he's trying to get past. And when you see a cartoon like this, it just accentuates that, and it just really adds a lot of credibility to a bad stereotype.
John, let me take that to our cartoonist, Scott Stantis.
Yeah, I was going to just jump in and say where Clarence touched on the right word, and that's successful illustration, editorial cartoon. And I would disagree with him slightly and say that this is an editorial cartoon, not in the pure sense, but it certainly is trying to project an idea and a use of satire. And I produce over 300 of these things a year, and I would look at this as a failure because, you know, satire has to be broad and it has to be very explicit and implicit in its intent. And this one, as all of us have said, we understand what they were trying to do, and I think we're all pretty much on the same page saying that they didn't quite get there.
Is it fair, Scott? Is this a fair caricature, or is it just
it's totally unfair. That's the and that's the point of satire, is you're trying to show how absurd it is that the, like I said, the more right-wing opponents of Barack Obama are painting him as some kind of, I mean, trust me, as a conservative myself, you hear these loopy ideas that he is even part of a sleeper cell in the United States, which is, of course, is absurd. Now, the part that may upset, as Clarence said, the left more, is this idea kind of seeping into the American consciousness and getting some kind of credence. I mean, it's absurd, of course.
Well, we know very well that it's out there. We've heard interviews on NPR just in the last few days of people saying...
I'll tell you, I get it all the time. I get it when I go out and talk, and it's stunning when I give a speech and someone will come up to me who you presume has, you know, some two brain cells to rub together, will say, well, you know he's a Muslim.
Carolyn, I want to get you, but let me go to Alma in Somerville, Massachusetts first. Alma, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I would like to ask the cartoonist, because I don't know if he's ever tested this kind of thing outside the bubble of New York City, but I want to tell him that, believe me, there are people out there, for instance, a good friend of mine who is a high school graduate and a nice person, but when she heard on Rush Limbaugh that Barack Obama was not a citizen, she put credibility to that. She didn't even know that you can't run for president unless you're a citizen.
Right, even though we must say that is, of course, not true.
Yeah, they say it's absurd, but people believe that stuff. You've got to get outside of the city and out to the country and the rest of the people, because they're not nearly as sophisticated as we would like to think, and you're sowing tremendous seeds of doubt. And this election, I believe, is so critical to this country that if we lose it, we are in very, very, very bad trouble.
Carolyn Marvin, one of our callers talked about the timing of this, said it might have been funny the week after, let's say, an Obama victory. And I agree, you know, it might have been then, though on who the joke would be, I don't know, but... the timing, this strikes me potentially as a kind of slow release item here that could continue to sort of, you know, it's going to make the rounds for weeks and weeks and months, maybe right up to Election Day.
Yeah, I think that was very insightful by your caller, actually. And I think it is because, you know, it's uncertain who is going to win and what's going to be involved and what are the stakes. But I also think what your caller said there the sort of as if predicate. Well, what if Obama were Muslim? And I think we can safely say that if he actually were, he wouldn't be a candidate for president. Just like if he were gay, he would be unlikely to be a candidate for president. Or if he were Jewish, it might be hard for him to be a candidate for president. So this is partly about what we can't imagine about our presidents in the Oval Office. We think of this campaign as being quite remarkable, and it is, because an African-American is a presidential candidate, and a woman had a very strong chance to be a presidential candidate. But I also want to say that I think this cartoon is has signs of this, of kind of careful restraint, because, you know, it would, I think we would be having a different discussion, for example, if Obama were holding the AK-47. And I think it's important that the expression that Obama and Michelle have is a very sweet one, and it's very affectionate one between them. And in some way that, you know, that keeps the thing...
pulls a little bit of sting?
Yes, I do think it pulls a little bit of sting out of it, and I think that's a very important part of that.
Let me get one more caller. Peter Amherst, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Peter. We've just got a minute, Peter.
Yeah, very quickly. I just wanted to say we've been subscribing to The New Yorker for, I don't know, years, and this cover is we are canceling our subscription. And it's just because I hope the editors and whoever was in the boardroom of The New Yorker had a good chuckle at what they decided to put on the cover, because I think that's, in the broad scheme, who's going to get the joke. And I believe that our country is at much too critical of a juncture right now to be feeding a stereotype like this. And yes, I am a liberal, but I think it's vital that we give every opportunity we can for an election to go forth without these type of stereotypes.
Peter, we've got it. Subscription canceled in Amherst. Clarence Page, last word goes to you, my friend. Are there times in politics where the stakes are just too high?
When some conservatives said it was the end of irony. Right now, we're seeing the end of irony of sorts among liberals in particular. New York Times has a story today about how comedy shows are having a hard time writing jokes about Barack Obama because people don't want to laugh. They'll laugh about people around them, but they won't laugh at Barack. So we're in a weird time right now.
Oh, boy. We'll try and laugh through the pain here. We appreciate each of you being with us. Clarence Page with the Chicago Tribune. Always great to have you, Clarence. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
Scott Stantis with the Birmingham News, joining us from Hoover, Alabama. Scott, keep on drawing, my friend.
Tom, thank you so much.
And Carolyn Marvin at the University of Pennsylvania Annenberg School for Communications. Carolyn, thank you very much for stepping up today.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.